This is the second day of this November 2015 7-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday. The book is called Zibo, the last great Zen master of China. This is translated by J.C. Cleary. Zibo was a 16th century Chinese master. We just covered his biography yesterday, and now we'll plunge into his teaching. When the sharp sword comes out of its case, the rays of light flash in the sun. It cuts through iron as if it were clay. Whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by, it is sure to become a vessel. This is good use of the sword. The sword is our prajna wisdom, our fundamental awareness. One word for that awareness, that fundamental awareness, is Buddha. You could say it's our Buddha nature, our Bodhi mind, wisdom mind. This is something that we all have in equal measure. It's always right with us, this sharp sword. Though the sword is sharp, there's a certain kind of fool who only uses it to cut mud. No vessel is formed of the mud, and the sword blade is progressively ruined. This is bad use of the sword. In other words, misusing the mind and its innate wisdom and its power of awareness. When he said earlier, whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by, it is sure to become a vessel. This is the potential we all share of becoming vessels of service and becoming bodhisattvas to help others to relieve suffering. Sometimes in the text they refer to very promising monk as a great vessel, a vessel of the Dharma. He goes on, this is like the basic subtle wonder inherent in the minds of living beings. They do not use concentration and wisdom to contemplate it, but just indulge in clinging to objects, running after sensory experience without turning back, flowing on through birth and death, illusion and suffering ever deeper with no escape. How could this be good use of mind? I think of misusing the mind through reading unnecessary things, reading or attending to trivial things, clinging to objects, running after sensory experience, attachment, in other words, deepening our attachments rather than cutting through our attachments, which means seeing through the nature of attachment. Those of sharp faculties and superior wisdom use the light of the mind's inherent nature to shine through sense faculties and sense objects to reveal that both lack reality nature. That is, they lack anything of any substance to them. They're without enduring substance. When the work of concentration and wisdom is achieved, right within sensory affliction, they find liberation. Right within emotional consciousness, they reach the light of wisdom. Think of this this ancient image in Buddhism of the lotus. The lotus does not grow out of the soil, the lofty soil of the highlands, but it grows out of the swamp, out of the mud, the mud of delusion. If you use the sword like this, you are bound to cut through diamonds and jade. All the vessels formed will be strong, complete, and imperishable, filled with sweet dew to offer libations to all. Whoever is touched by a drop will have his burning vexations become pure and cool. He will find immeasurable hundreds of thousands of samadhis. None comes from outside because all are inherent in the nature of mind. Right within sensory affliction, they find liberation. Right within emotional consciousness, they reach the light of wisdom. Reminded of Sesshin, the kind of dredging that we do in Sesshin. As the upper levels of the mind become quieter, we expose these three poisons in the mind. Yes, right in Sesshin. Greed or grasping, cravings. We see this with painful clarity in Sesshin. Same with the many forms of ill will, anger, irritation, critical judgments of others and of oneself, and the delusion, the confusion. All of these, none of these are deal breakers. They're all the hand we're dealt as humans. It's our species facing greed, anger, and delusion, and not being pulled under by it, seeing it, but not dwelling in these awful things we see about our nature. That's Sesshin. Or if not Sesshin, any delving into the mind through pure Zazen, we see these shadows. And yet we see, if we maintain our awareness and keep returning our attention to the practice we're working on, then we, in effect, see through these things. We see that fundamentally there's nothing to them. They're just states, passing states, shifting states of mind, shifting emotions, feelings. Above all, we don't want to waste time despising these defilements in ourselves. We don't have to rid ourselves of greed, anger, and delusion to come to awakening. Right in the midst, as he says, right within emotional consciousness, they reach the light of wisdom. That is when we learn not to attach to these states and not to make it about me, my character, my nature. How do we avoid that? It's so natural when we see things in ourselves, in our reactions to people and circumstances, to become critical of ourselves. Well, we do it by putting our faith entirely in the practice we're working on, not making the mistake of referring all this to ourselves. There's no self there that these things can stick to. They're just old kind of patterns of energy, patterns of reactions to things, but they have no roots. He continues, thus it is said, for one who makes good use of mind, the 84,000 afflictions are 84,000 samadhis. For one who makes bad use of mind, the 84,000 samadhis are 84,000 afflictions. Ah, the sword is basically no different. With good use, every cut is accomplished. With bad use, day by day, the sword goes to ruin. So how is it that the 84,000 samadhis can become 84,000 afflictions? Well, samadhi just means complete absorption in the object that we're facing. So we can become absorbed in things that bind us to suffering. I think of the internet. How many hours people can spend transfixed by things on the internet, not just pornography, but other things. Lost. This what he's talking about with these all these forms of absorption. Is losing one's awareness, one's balance through this kind of attachment. Becoming completely lost in shopping, becoming lost in news, filling hours and hours as time gets by without us noticing. In whatever it is that we become transfixed by. Food. The last few years, this has become a new potential samadhi that people can get into is cooking and dwelling endlessly about little details and subtleties and discriminations about food and the preparation of food, and you see it splashed everywhere. Celebrity chefs. There are people who take great pride in their ability to discriminate among different kinds of dishes and anything can become these kinds of afflictions. But behind it all is this potential we have to become one with anything. It's different for different people. Sports. People can spend half of their day thinking about or talking about sports. This is their samadhi. It's poignant because it confirms the power of the mind to become one with whatever it is, whatever our circumstances are. But it's such a waste of time in terms of liberating the mind from its bondage to objects. It's a tremendous waste of time. A doesn't mean never to do any of these things. Of course, there's a place for that, but it's a misuse of the mind when we devote too much time to it. When always there is waiting for us this practice that we have in Zen that we could be doing. There is true light and there is false light. The true shines through 10,000 ages without relativity. The false is the light emitted when glued to the six sense objects. Pick a sense. Any of the six senses, in Buddhism we talk about the thought, thinking, or thought as being the sixth sense, but any of them, and you see how we can misuse the sense. Sight, sound, taste, smell, feeling, tactile, the sense of tactile feeling, and thought. The senses are not in themselves a problem. It's when we become glued, to use his word, become glued to these things, that we become captivated. We become captured by the senses. The next entry here is called Suffering is a Teacher. For those whose natural potential is crude and rough, the Buddha's words are an obstruction. For those whose natural potential is deep, even when myriad sufferings crowd around them, they are all teachers. All the sufferings become teachers. Hence the saying, use the mind well, and everywhere you touch is a basis for enlightenment. Don't use the mind well, and everywhere is obstruction. When I read this morning, I came to think about how many more people now in Sesshin will sometimes go to a chair to sit because of pain. And I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, it's great that we have the room where people who find that they're seriously their practice is impaired by pain, they have a way to continue their practice in a chair. But then there's the other side. Because sitting in a chair, it's more difficult to concentrate. Unless the pain becomes unmanageable, then it's better to use a chair. But it's that tipping point of that can be so difficult to identify is when could the pain take us to a deeper level of concentration if we just sat through it, and when would we be able to concentrate more effectively without sitting on a mat? And that's the negotiation that probably everyone has gone through in Sesshin, where we sit so many hours without moving. Is when do we hold and when do we fold? Pain, let's make this very simple. Pain has the power to deepen our concentration if we know how to use it. And what does that mean? How do we use pain? Well, the first thing is not to dwell in it. And dwell in it means not think about it. We bind ourselves to pain through our thoughts about it, which always means thoughts about ourselves. Oh, if we're thinking about our pain, we are really at the same time thinking about ourselves and our misery. Any number of thoughts about myself having pain. Well, that's the worst thing we can do when we're facing pain, physical pain in sitting. The best thing is, you know what, to put our mind more thoroughly, more deeply into the practice, the simple practice that we're working on, the breath, or the koan, whatever it is we're doing. Okay, people, most of you, maybe all of you, have learned this yourself. You know that you just have to, the real way to transcend the pain is to get more thoroughly and absorbed in the practice. But I wonder whether people sometimes they do that. They try to make a stronger effort to become concentrated in the practice, but then stop short of really getting on the other side of the pain. Pain, physical pain, can be used as a lever to strengthen our concentration on the practice. But not if we're only doing it halfway. If we allow thoughts to skirt around the mind about, oh, I hope this better work, this better work, this better work. I don't know. Blah, blah, blah. No, that's not enough. You can't entertain thoughts while you're trying to concentrate on the practice. You have to give it everything you've got. And then people who have done this have learned that pain is a great, great ally. Some of the best kind of force. It's a tool. It's a tool. And if we bail to a chair before we really need to, then it's just like tossing aside this tool and falling short of what we could, the freedom we could reach by pressing on, sitting through the pain. Now, I don't want people coming to me in Doksan and saying, but I have to. I have this. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, I can't judge your level of pain. Pain is a subjective experience. I'm not saying this with anyone in mind that you're giving up too easily. Only you can know that. But I did feel that by raising it, maybe there'd be one or two people who could stick it out further when they're facing pain, when they feel they're just about near their saturation point. And by sticking it out further, can discover the most amazing thing, which is that the mind is the chief determinant of our experience of pain. It's the mind. It's not the posture. It's the mind. Up to a point. and only each individual can negotiate that point, is when it makes better sense. The whole point is, how can we practice more effectively, sitting on the mat or sitting in a chair? And if you're convinced that going to a chair will enable you to sit more effectively, great. That's what we want, is you to be able to concentrate better. But that concentration can be fueled by the pain, and really be the best thing we could find. I've heard senior people who've been very seasoned in their practice, who have learned how to manage pain. Doesn't mean it goes away, but they've learned how, through the use of the mind, the practice, the pain becomes more manageable and less of a problem. People who will say, I kind of wish I had a little more pain, because it really helped my concentration. Well, one can do that. You can, if you have a choice between two postures, one that's a little more painful and one that's a little less, you can sit in the little one that's a little more painful and get that edge, that fine edge of concentration that you have to find when you're facing pain. It's I remember this. It's kind of an ultimatum. The pain becomes such that if you are dwelling in your thoughts, then it's awful. And so it kind of forces you, all right, I'll do anything. I'll even concentrate on my practice rather than have all this pain. And then you find that mind is master. We find that through the practice, our relationship to the pain changes. We don't have to get rid of the pain when we come to when we learn to not separate ourselves from it through thoughts about it. Always, the way to reduce suffering is to become one with, and that is done with the breath or the whatever the koan we're working on. In that, we are becoming one with the pain. To become one with mu is to become one with the pain. Become one with the breath means to become one with the pain. Once again, I'm not saying that anyone in particular should be staying on the mat instead of going to the chair. This is your decision. I can't know when it's wise to go to a chair for any one person. So back to this, hence the saying, use the mind well, and everywhere you touch is a basis for enlightenment. Don't use the mind well, and everywhere is obstruction. One kind of pain is itching. And I mention this because there's this inspiring story of Harada Roshi, Harada Sogaku Roshi, who was Roshi Kaplow's first main teacher in Japan. And when Kaplow-san landed at Hoshinji Temple and was training there, Harada Roshi told him that as a young man he had been so fiercely determined to come to awakening, that, and he knew, as so many Japanese do, about the value of pain as a tool to get deeper into one's practice, that he went into a bamboo grove, a swampy, wet bamboo grove, where he knew there'd be lots of mosquitoes, and he went in dressed in just a loincloth, so he was almost completely exposed, and the mosquitoes descended on him in a cloud. But he wouldn't move. He wouldn't let himself move. And the itching became so hideous, he said, that it drove him. Drove him into his hara, drove him into his practice that he was working on, and that's how he had his first kensho. You can even find that through complete concentration on the practice, the pain can vanish. One minute you're in agony, but you're not succumbing to it. You're not moving, and with 100% commitment to the practice, you can, in like that, find yourself. The pain is gone. When that needs to happen only once, to drive home the point that it's the mind is really your way out of pain. He continues in this passage about suffering. Before the primordial Buddha, before the Buddhas arose, there was no ground for the causal basis of enlightenment. Ultimately, who was the teacher of the primordial Buddha? Little do you realize that suffering was the teacher. What need was there for other indicators? After the primordial Buddha, there were various indications to influence people of various potentials. They used suffering, they used bliss, they used what's neither suffering nor bliss, myriad different means. As for the primordial Buddha, even though his natural potential was deep, unless he had been driven on by the flames of suffering, enlightenment would have been hard to develop. When his enlightenment did open up, all the causal bases for enlightening others flowed out from within him. This was the functioning of the primordial Buddha's fruit of enlightenment. Someone said, pain is the only instrument sharp enough to prune away the excesses of self. If we can sit through pain, we become humbled. We discover that the limits of our control, this egoistic notion of control, so many benefits to sitting through pain, but intelligently knowing the kind of pain you never want to sit through is sharp, stabbing pain. It's not very common, but it happens, and if that is happening, you just move, even in the middle of a round, change your posture. One final thing, and then I'll shut up. This is not a moral. It's not a moral issue. This is not a matter of being brave and strong. Blah blah blah. It's just how to use this tool. that can take our practice to another level. It's just about being effective in your practice, using everything you've got. It's not a character issue. The next passage he calls knowing and awakening. Reality, nature is like water. Feelings are like ice. Now, let me pause because this can be misleading. When he talks about feelings here, he's really talking about feelings based on self and other. He knows that to be sentient means that you feel things, and not just physical pain. You feel emotional things. You feel pain and joy. This is human nature. That doesn't go away after enlightenment. But he's talking about more of, again, feelings that are ego-based, self and other, us and them. So reality nature, or you say Buddha nature, is like water. Feelings are like ice. Ice is a solid obstruction. Water is fluid and flows through. Free-flowing, it is fundamentally without subject and object. As a solid obstruction, sense faculties and sense objects are in opposition. So, feelings for beginners, anyone else would know this by now, but for beginners, for the sake of beginners, feelings are our way of responding to feelings in Zen is the same as responding to thoughts. It is, in and of themselves, they're not good or bad. They only become a problem when we cling to them. So whatever the feeling is, let's say regret. You're sitting, it's not uncommon in Sesshin to feel remorse as you remember, memories come up of things you've done or said. And that's just fine. It's neither good nor bad. Remorse comes up. The problem is when we cling to it, grasping, holding on to those feelings, wallowing in those feelings, that becomes a problem. Problem just because it hinders our practice. It impedes us. Either that or trying to block out or suppress the feeling. That's the other mistake. So we want to always, just as with thoughts, we neither want to suppress them nor cling to them. And the same with feelings and emotions. They arise. Thoughts arise. Feelings arise. Emotions arise. That's what happens when you have sentience. But then when we notice the thought or the feeling or the emotion, to neither suppress or nor to cling to. And then the feeling will just move through, move out sooner or later. Some feelings, some thoughts, some emotions stick around longer than others, but they all pass eventually. They pass if we're neither trying to suppress them nor cling to them. They'll pass. So how do you do that? How do you neither suppress them nor cling to them? You do mu. You do the breath. That's it. You don't have to figure anything out. We get out of the way of these potential obstructions when we just lose ourselves in the practice. It happens on its own. We don't have to direct these things. He continues, there is knowing these meanings, and there is awakening to these meanings. With knowing, the ideas are understood, But in contact with things and events, there is still delusion. With awakening, in contact with things and events, you understand their inner truth, that sentiments and sense objects are of themselves empty. So the difference between getting it conceptually, everyone, I think, hopefully everyone can understand this conceptually, but then there's nothing like it, the experience of trying this out and confirming for oneself the truth of these things. There's only one way we can do that is through the experience. Delusion is the entanglement of feelings. Awakening is meshing with true nature. Entanglement means duality. Meshing means oneness. Duality implies relativity. Oneness implies birthlessness, or that which is beyond birth and death, the eternal. Birthlessness is the constant principle of true nature. Relativity is the transformation of true nature. We'll get to that in a second, transformation. Constancy is selfless and luminous. Transformation means having sentiments and being dimmed. Here, transformation means that we convert this essential nature of ours, of by which we see the indivisible nature of everything, converting that into dualistic notions, concepts. That's the transformation he means here. Thus, knowledge within darkness cannot vanquish the darkness. He's still talking about conceptual knowledge. So then the path is no match for habitual actions. With luminosity, here this is the realm of no mind, no thought, with luminosity, habitual actions do not get the better of awareness, so that without depending on cultivation, one directly enters enlightenment. Otherwise, even if you relinquish countless bodies and lives, it just adds to the karma of contrived activity. This is because awakening is close to immediate awareness, direct experience, while knowing, conceptual knowledge, is close to comparative awareness, dualistic awareness. Thus, what can be achieved by knowing and awakening differs. Let me just read this sentence again. With luminosity, habitual actions or reactions, let's say, habit forces of acting and reacting, do not get the better of awareness. Again, it's the thoughts that bind us to our habit forces, our karma. When we can find our way into this realm of no thought, then we're free. And so that without depending on cultivation, in other words, leaving aside practice, one directly enters enlightenment through the one portal to enlightenment is the realm of no thought. No mindedness, which doesn't mean having no thoughts. It just means not dwelling in them, not trafficking in thoughts, not clinging to them. There will always be some thought activity in the mind, but as long as we remain detached from it through absorption in the practice, then we are free of that. I see that our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.